Hello, friends. Kyle Tierman here, and welcome to another episode of my podcast. This one was recorded straight out of Bozeman, midway through a week-long hunt that I did with my buddy Kevin Grunewald. You may recognize Kevin's voice on this podcast, as he's been a guest in previous episodes. I met him a few years ago when I was on the road in Colorado, and Kevin was stewarding a beautiful piece of land we talk about a little bit in this episode. And he sent me an email. He said, "Hey, man, listen to your podcast. Heard you're in Colorado. Got a place for you to crash. Beautiful river for you to fly fish if you want to come out." So I said, "Hell yeah." It was COVID. There was nothing I had going on. So I said, "Sure." And since then, we've become great friends. Kevin is one of the smartest, most badass, intellectually curious people I know. Very encyclopedic knowledge, and I'm sure is cowering away from these compliments like a vampire in the sun. His humility precedes him, but the dude knows a lot and is just one of the most epic people to go tromping through the woods with, because he's just a walking, interesting fact machine. As is his wonderful girlfriend, Kelsey. Hey, Kelsey. Thanks so much for letting me crash on your couch. Spent a week with these two, hunting in the day, cooking tasty meals at night, and just having a grand old time. It's been a perennial trip for me to make it out and visit them. And it's a nice way to punctuate my life. I find that having friends who live in another state and who I visit every year, it always makes me think, "Oh, what was I doing this time last year?" And most of our days are filled not looking at phones, just hiking through the woods with rifles. And it gives you a lot of time to think about life, about what is important, what have been the highlights over the past year. And I think that those punctuation marks and open space and open time to think can be real compasses to direct where we should go next in life. And that's it's not always easy to do, to tune into that when you're blinded by the incessant hum of technology and tasks. So I'm very grateful to Kevin and Kelsey for allowing me to crash their party out there, and we had a great time. For those of you who don't know, I do a weekly newsletter. Every week I ask a question, ponder it myself, and do a little dispatch, a little rant on how I'm thinking about the question. A lot of you seem to have been enjoying it. So if you want to hear a bit more from me through the written word, you can just click the link below this podcast or go to tierman.substack.com and give me your email. Give me your email. And you'll get just a newsletter from me once a week. It's also a way that you won't miss podcasts when they come up next. All right, here's the official bio of Kevin, and then we will get this podcast started. Kevin Grunewald is a Montana-based conservationist, hunter, and angler. His winding career path in conservation biology has seen him teaching students how to trap bats in the outback of Australia, guiding clients to experience bear country in Alaska, dissecting zebrafish embryos in a university laboratory in Wisconsin, and conducting and sharing the benefits of sound ecological land stewardship practices on nature preserves in California and Colorado. His former role as the land steward with the Nature Conservancy, Kevin worked and lived at a remote field station and nature preserve called Phantom Canyon. Now he's based in Bozeman and spends his days working in, exploring, and sharing the wonder of the natural landscapes that he aspires to conserve. Please welcome to the podcast, Kevin Grunewald.
Kyle Tierman here. I'm in Cape Town.
I was the only journalist in northern Nigeria.
It's not an adventure until you get lost in Tijuana.
You get caught inside by a giant wave, you feel really alone.
I love the adventure of waking up and not knowing what will happen and that being my job.
I'm standing at a desert oasis right now.
A lot of tourists don't see this part of El Bali.
Smiles and thumbs up.
We're ready to go. Kevin Grunewald's back on the podcast. Kyle here with some soda in his voice from a quick sickness, quick bout that I was able to recover from quickly on this hunt. I'm very happy I was able to do that because yesterday, trekking for most of the day as we hunted grouse was not fun, shivering all over my body. Makes just walking through the woods significantly harder, I've found, having the flu. So, got a good night's sleep last night, feeling energized, ready to go, and all of you lovely listeners get to be the beneficiaries of me feeling like a bit more leathery on this podcast. Happy to be here. Last time you were on this podcast was a couple years ago in Phantom Canyon when we did our antelope hunt, which was a freaking blast.
Yeah.
Antelope hunting's like, I really love it because there's so much action. The amount of animals that we were seeing on that property that, I mean, it's hard hunting, but just to be able to put so many stocks on animals was, I felt like I improved my hunting from that trip, even though we didn't harvest an animal.
Yeah. Yeah, to call it a blast is kind of funny because we were archery hunting. There were no blasts happening.
Right.
But you're absolutely right that you look across this big sagebrush landscape and you can see many animals, including animals that you wouldn't get to in an hour if you hiked in that direction. And that gives you a lot of opportunities to hone your ability to sneak up on them undetected.
Right. Are they the fastest land animal besides a cheetah? Or what's this? There's some stat about the antelope speed, right?
Fastest land animal in North America.
Okay.
65 miles per hour.
That's fucking crazy.
That's their fastest. It is incredible. Yeah. And likely we've talked about this before, but the reason they think that they can do that, run so fast, even though none of their predators can run even nearly that fast, is because they co-evolved with the American cheetah before the last ice age. So they retained this ability to run extremely fast to get away from a predator that does not exist on the landscape anymore.
And it just, it's like, you know, like our pinky toe or something like that, where they're like, huh, what, like, why do we still use this for?
I would much rather be able to, I would give my pinky toe
to be able to run 65. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, well, I remember that was one of the first things I saw when we first met, I guess, 4 years ago now, and you invited me to Phantom Canyon. I remember driving in along that sagebrush landscape and seeing all these antelope just run across the plain. And what was so surprising to me is that then when I arrived at Phantom Canyon, it's just this massive crater in the earth that you would not expect to be right at the center of mostly flat landscape.
Yeah, water and time
right.
can do incredible things. In that case, the North Fork of the Cache Laputa River cut a big old canyon in the ground, 700-foot drop, vertical descent down to that river from the top. And yeah, I mean, that's just the kind of thing that's been sculpted over time. And if you went back far enough, it would just be totally flat, open sagebrush sea, but a trickle of water over many, many, many eons.
So how did you arrive at Phantom Canyon? And for people who don't know, just give a little background on what you were doing there.
Sure, yeah. So I was born in... Just kidding.
no, don't do it.
Well, gosh, what year? 2017, I started working there. So Phantom Canyon Preserve is a property owned by the Nature Conservancy in Colorado. It is north of Fort Collins, and it's a private nature reserve owned by that nonprofit. And I arrived there for the job. I was essentially, sometimes I find myself describing it as I was like a private land park ranger. And I wore a lot of different hats, including I would do different land stewardship projects like replacing or removing barbed wired fence with more wildlife friendly fencing, or do trail maintenance, or regular landscaping tasks in order to serve all of the visitors that came through, and spraying noxious weeds off of the property, maintaining neighborly landowner contacts in the area, and also forwarding some of our conservation initiatives, doing a little bit of scientific research on site, working with locals on sort of broader landscape scale conservation initiatives, and hosting a lot of people to explain what we were up to out at Phantom Canyon.
Did you ever think that you'd be able to live at a spot like that? It is, it is a world-class private fly fishing river that you had access to whenever you wanted. There's antelope hunting. I mean, it is a vista out your front door that most people would have to have, sold Nike to be able to live at.
And in fact, I did host people sometimes that
had done
similar caliber things. And yeah, so grateful. Such a cool opportunity to spend time living in a place that most people are lucky to come recreate. It was an incredible experience. And yeah, world-class fly fishing right out your door and antelope hunting. And it was an intentional thing. You know, I for years before I arrived at Phantom Canyon, I had also spent time guiding in natural kind of wild places. I had done a lot of kind of remote or far-flung research projects for different conservation research going on, and had also worked for the Nature Conservancy prior, which is what really landed me in this position. I worked for them prior in Northern California on the McLeod River Preserve, and that work really translated well because I was also living at a destination fly fishery, hosting donors to the Nature Conservancy, doing land stewardship work, and also hosting lots of visitors. So I had a little bit of a foot in the door, as you do when you start to make some contacts, specifically within a company or an industry, and reached out and made a good connection with the person that was doing the hiring. And they said, "Hey, do you want this like incredible, amazing, once in a lifetime job?" And I said, "I sure do." So I ended up in Colorado that way.
Right. And did you, have you always felt like you were going to work in, or in conservation? Like it was it not really?
No, I don't think I could have told you that I am going to work in conservation, right, even when I graduated college back in 2013. I've always been into the natural sciences.
Yeah, and living a wild life and just being amongst it.
Yeah, and I've always wanted that kind of raw personal experience to draw from to
fortify yourself,
right?
As
exactly,
as a human soul.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a little bit, and just be able to draw my own conclusions about the world from what I considered to be the most honest type of experience, which was just me kind of out there learning by way of doing.
Tell me more about that.
I spent some time while I was in college doing some very esoteric neuroscience research, where I was staring at zebrafish developing under microscopes and looking very specifically at certain cells developing in their body and how those cells move at very specific times in their life. And it was just very narrow, a little too narrow, and not quite real world. I guess you could argue that's the realist, right?
You're looking on a cellular level.
You might be
level.
The first person to see or know something doing that kind of research, and I certainly respect the people doing it. But to me, I grew up in Wisconsin. I went to school in Wisconsin, and I wanted exposure to just the broader world out there. And to me, I guess that meant going to far-flung natural places just to see what would happen.
Right. And when it comes to observing nature to come to your own conclusions about the world, what do you mean by that?
I mean that, I don't know what I mean. I guess right. I'm still trying to find that out.
Right. I've heard a line a long time ago, which was nature is the most honest reflection of ourselves. And it stuck with me because it feels like there's a lot of truth to that statement. And it feels to me like the human brain is, and the human ego is so adaptable to its surroundings that you can really easily gain an outsized perspective of yourself and your importance in the world, and your values can just get so shaped by your environment so easily. I think that we're all very susceptible to that. And it's a really scary thing when you start seeing people fall into the trap of fame. You know, I think that's why so many famous people get fucked up, is because you are constantly being told something about yourself by the external world that isn't really true. It's just this small sliver of you, right? Like a movie actor is the ultimate example. I fucking love you in that movie that you played the cowboy, and you know, you're getting this false validation about yourself, and then you start to see yourself in the face of the world in a very outsized way, which I think can lead to grandiosity. I think it can lead to a lot of depression. And I think that nature is one of the greatest antidotes to that, because it's just so not about you.
Yeah, I think, you know, they say you are the average of the five people you hang out with the most, right?
And you're hanging out with black bears.
And if three of those people are a dog, a black bear, and a fish you just caught, then yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say
That's
is
funny.
You know, you sort of, I wanted to move in the direction of living in a little bit more of a, not a vacuum, but to escape those influences you're talking about, and to be able to reflect on things happening around me without other inputs or other people or things reflecting on them.
Right.
Which isn't to say I was totally alone all the time, but I dialed it back a little, and I wanted to zoom out and away from the tiny little cell I was staring at to the bigger world, in the name of just learning by doing and exposure. Because I was very aware at the time that I hadn't been exposed to very much, and I probably wouldn't be unless I just got out of there.
Right. Well, you'd been a hunter your whole life, so you'd always had a kind of a good amount of time in nature. But is it? And then you had guided in Alaska. You had been in a lot of these wild places, but I'm assuming that it just ramped up quite a bit when you started living alone on this pristine piece of land in Phantom Canyon.
Yeah, so my initial motivations were to get out, get some exposure. I actually lived in a big city at first. I went to Australia and lived in Melbourne, and I spent a lot of time outside of the big city. But after seeking that at first, then nature appealed for different ways, or a lifestyle with more time spent in the natural world started to appeal. And I certainly have sought that out since, you know, not least because I just find it to be a really ideal level of stimulation for myself. I think I would consider myself to naturally be an introvert. And I think we talked about it the other day. You know, we had a great big hike in a beautiful canyon on this hunt. And on the way home, we just felt like, although we didn't harvest an animal today, sure would have liked to, but although that didn't happen, we both just felt like we could call it for the day, you know? Like, that was enough. It just felt like we had done enough. And to me, that's such a, that level of satisfaction is something I feel every time I've been out in the natural world. And I can just be observing and moving through it, and it just feels like it's enough.
Hmm. You've told me also on this trip, you've brought up the concept of information diets. and I think you have, right? Of like what's you I think are aware of the information and to the point of stimulation, and like what information are you ingesting and how is that impacting your thoughts? And yeah, I would imagine that you become even more sensitive to that when you are out in a place alone. Am I making that up? This idea of information diets? You just looked at me like I was crazy.
I don't think I phrased it that way, but I do think that we've been talking about that. Yeah, absolutely. If you spend more time on your own out there in the wilds, you are more aware of your own personal habits of thought and thought patterns and how those are influenced by the media, for example, that you're taking in, or the book that you're reading. You know, I think if it's Halloween in time and you're watching lots of horror movies, you expect when you step out at night to get stabbed yeah, in the face, right?
Great example.
So if you're ingesting that kind of material, it just feels more likely things are happening. And certainly that's just one example of how you can feel more danger in the world. If you're ingesting a lot of risky, dangerous, the world is burning material. But yeah, there are other ways to change the way you think by exposing yourself purposefully or not to different types of inputs.
Do you think about that before you pick up a book or watch a TV show? Like, you're not really on social media very much, but is that a question that you'll ask yourself typically?
No. This is a classic, like,
do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah. Which is like another way, I think you've told me before, of saying, don't ask me about that.
Right.
I chase my interests. I mean, I don't think I vet the material coming my way. I check the news more often than I'd like to.
Yeah.
I'm aware of how I'm being affected.
I remember you texted me when I was in LA and you're like, "Hey man, are you doing all right with this storm?" And I was like, "I haven't even looked at the news, man." And then it was like trickling rain outside.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing your perception of the world and how it can change based on the media you're consuming, which won't be news to anybody. But I have moved toward a more connected lifestyle these days. And that was purposeful too. I wanted to plug back in a little bit to the matrix, and it's been a good move because I do think that, you know, I reaped a lot of the benefits and rewards of living alone in the mountains for a while, which isn't to say that that was all I was doing even at the time, but it was time to revert to a little more conventional lifestyle, especially because I can see that if you don't do that, it's quite easy to become the hermit in the woods.
Right. Yeah. It's right? Like, it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. It's like, do hermits seek a solitary space, or does the solitary space create the hermit?
Right. Right. I'm sure it's a little bit of both, or at least I think it probably is a little bit of both. And yeah, those patterns of thought can become a little too entrenched.
Totally. Well, there's a line in Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, which is about psychedelics, where he says reflection and rumination can be helpful and on the face of it, good qualities to have. You want to be someone who's reflecting, but if you do it too much, it can very quickly spiral into incessant thoughts of the self, and you start to doubt who you are and what you're doing, and you begin to have this kind of mental dysphoria in a way that isn't helpful. And it's like, we've all met people who are just fucking thinking too much. And I personally, like, I'm susceptible to those thought patterns. And I've really chosen to spend a lot of time outdoors and a lot of times really tiring myself out physically for the purpose of tackling that issue. Because similarly, like, we go hike along the Madison River up through some incredible canyon alone, and after that I feel much more calm, much more easeful, in a way that I can't get when I'm not in nature. So I sometimes wonder how much my kind of yearning to spend a lot of time in the outdoors is simply a response to my tendency towards anxious rumination. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read this great book last winter called The Nature Fix. Not recalling the author right now. She's a really great writer. And she talks about kind of the one thing she talks about is the soft fascination that being in the outdoors brings to us naturally, and how that has a way of calming you down, but also helping you to avoid that kind of negative rumination. I think you that word rumination is kind of funny. You know, it has such negative connotation, and I immediately think of ruminants, right? Which are animals that digest things differently than we do.
Mm.
Like a cow is a ruminant, an elk is a ruminant, a deer. All these animals we've been pursuing are ruminants. They're animals with multi-chambered stomachs that are herbivores that spend a lot of time chewing and digesting plant matter in the same way that the word rumination, you know, in this context must mean to digest.
It must have the same Latin root.
Right. And these animals ruminate.
That's so interesting.
At rest, they lay down and chew the cud, you know?
Right, right.
Which is another metaphor for conversation.
So when we were hanging out last 2 years ago, you know, you said that you told me that you were just feeling a little bit like you weren't sure what the next move was, because you got, in some ways, these golden handcuffs to be living out on this property, you're ODing on nature, you know, you have this great job and there's really no reason to leave, but you were expressing to me like a bit of that anxiety of like, well, what am I going to do next? I'm not really sure. If I leave this property, am I going to regret it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe I would have voiced it this way at the time. I think my biggest fear, and I was probably 28, 29 at the time, my biggest fear was that I would stagnate, you know, and just do this forever and grow old. And this is the pattern of thought. This is kind of the way of life I would have forever, and that would become problematic. Just to be that same person in that same frame of mind forever. I'm just not interested in that. I just wanted to explore more, see more.
Right.
And there were certain elements from my life that were missing. I was very aware there was a lack of community living on the landscape on your own for long periods of time.
Just listening to podcasts.
There was a lot
enough
of that.
You don't get
yeah.
to talk back.
I had a friend from New York City, a college buddy at the time, who told me, he's like, "You've done it, man. You've hacked the system. You are hanging out with these CEOs and taking them fly fishing, doing what they do during their recreational time when they can find time, and you get to do it every day." And
right.
I was like, yeah. Yeah, but it's just not, it's not as rewarding if that's all you do, quite frankly. Like, I know fishing guides that say that the best way to ruin fishing for yourself is to become a fishing guide.
For sure. Yeah, well, I think it's one of the great mistakes that humans make is they think, oh, I love this thing, I mean it can go both ways, but I do think that a lot of people will, I see it in surfing all the time, people are like, oh, I love surfing, so I'm now going to get a job in the surf industry, I'm going to form my whole life to be about catching the best waves possible. And very quickly you catch the best waves possible. Like, if you're seeking that and orienting your entire life around catching the best waves possible, you can fucking do it. You can fucking do it. Like, you can do it pretty cheaply as well. Like, you can kind of hack flights and figure out where the waves are that are going to be world class at that time, and you do it. But then after that happens, there's pretty often this terrifying thought where you think, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a multivariant life, you can start to then become very angry and very crotchety, because then every other wave you catch is not as good as that perfect 10 wave that you got 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're all just you're comparing it to that. Whereas the happiest people I see, they have a lot of different hobbies and they can kind of move between them so that they maintain enthusiasm for all of them. But it takes a certain amount of real deliberate effort, because the second you pick up a new thing, whether it's a new job in a new industry or a new hobby, you suck at it very likely, and it sucks to suck, and it feels really good to crush it at shit.
Sure.
Even if you're a big fish in a small pond, that feels really good. So it takes a certain amount of recognizing what those feelings are and not letting them lead you around to have a more interesting life.
Right. I think progress and, variety is the spice of life, and, feeling like you're progressing in something definitely rewards us naturally. I think I certainly, have enjoyed learning to shoot a bow better. And I've learned a few other, learned to drive stick on a truck on a dirt road somewhere. And you just feel good when you can bring those skills into your quiver. And don't know where I'm going with that, but just to follow the ruminant metaphor, sometimes you need more grass. You can't just chew on that cud forever. You gotta go find some other stuff to
for sure
to feed on, and then you can digest that later. So you just gotta continue to go find new experiences to bring in to your identity.
So I had a guy on this podcast years ago named Don Mira, who on the show delivered this concept, which is, it's just for now. That was his motto through life. It's just for now. And it was really helpful for me, because I was feeling some stagnation in my life and fear to take a leap into a world that I knew very little about. Moving away from my hometown and getting a new job in a new industry. And he said, it's just for now. And whenever I think of that, it lowers the stakes on that, any decision, so much that it makes you feel like, yeah, fuck it, I may as well just try. And I found it incredibly helpful. And I remember I told it to you, and you said that it was helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Helpful reminder from you, and I think of that often. You encourage me to take the leap. It's just for now, so you can make that change and you can always come back to this thing. And I do think maybe the arc of my life will eventually bring me back to a Phantom Canyon somewhere. Seems like a good place to end up. But yeah, it encouraged me to, end up in Montana, which is where I am now, which was kind of a big leap out of that seemingly perfect job in Colorado, but things are still good.
Yeah.
And I actually prefer my current trajectory more than at the time in many ways. So yeah, it was helpful to get that nudge from you.
You're welcome for
credit you with.
Well, do you know what's really weird and funny? So when I was staying at Phantom Canyon with you, my next stop on that big road trip was Montana. And the first place that I drove through Yellowstone, drove from your spot to Wyoming, and hiked the Wind River Range for a few days, spent a couple nights in Jackson Hole, and then went to Montana. And the first, so I went through to Montana by way of Yellowstone. And the first place I stopped was Stacy's, which is this old fucking cowboy bar that is so sick. And if anyone's coming through Gallatin Gateway, Stacy's will make you feel like you are. I mean, it's really my voice right now as a bar. If you could imagine what that is like, that Stacy's. And that was the first place that you went to as well when you came to Montana. And now you're living not too far away from there.
Yeah. It's a nice little, melting pot of Montana there, because you can get the Patagonia vests and also the guys with the spurs on at the bar. And everybody's reveling in how they just spent a day out in the whatever, either wrangling cattle or looking for cow elk or fly fishing or chasing their dog or whatever they were up to out there.
I know we were saying that we should, rather than
scouting all day. We should just go sit at the bar at Stacy's and ask old timers where the elk are.
Honestly, that two Coors Lights we had at the bar with the gentleman next to us
garnered more.
Oh yeah,
more way information.
Right. Than us just communicating in the field about. I wonder if we should go try this spot.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think you'd do yourself a service to make your first stop in Montana, Stacy's Bar in Gallatin Gateway.
Sponsored by Stacy's Bar. So your first, so when you left Phantom Canyon and you moved to Montana, the first work you were doing was in Yellowstone. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so moved up because my lovely girlfriend Kelsey was offered a job as a large animal veterinarian in the area, and I was like, Bozeman, yeah, that sounds great. Bozeman is right next door to Yellowstone National Park, and I actually was back and forth a little bit at first trying to wrap up my position in Colorado, and then the first full-time position that was offered to me was a summer guiding in Yellowstone National Park, which I jumped on quickly, and I'm sure glad I did.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Had you spent much time in Yellowstone before that job?
No, my parents took me to Yellowstone once as a kid. I was probably about 10 years old, maybe spent 2 days in Yellowstone prior. Made some really long-lasting memories at the time.
Really?
And I have reflected on, it's interesting what memories you make and do not make on a trip like that as a kid, because I'm sure I was exposed to so much, but I remember two very odd things in the park. A gurgling hot spring, a particular one called the Dragon's Cauldron. You'd think a guide would remember the name of that one. It's kind of a small feature in the park. And Dragon's Mouth is what it's called. And also just a gigantic bull elk, because at the time my reference for deer-like animals were tiny little whitetails in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
and so to be
this fucking dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly. And that was my reference point. So anyway, those things stuck in my mind, but Yellowstone has so much going on that it's interesting that I only retain those two memories.
So you told me the other day a fun fact about Yellowstone, which is, you're like, so how, it was about magma, and right? It was, and if, I'm going to fuck this up, you tell me, how deep the magma.
We'll see how good a job I did by explaining it, by you telling me back what I told you.
All right, I'll do my best. So if the Earth's crust was, what would just remind me the you just got to do it. I'm so sorry. I remember what the stat was, but I forget what the analogy was.
No, it's fine. I had to hear this a few times before it stuck in my head. So if you have a ream of paper.
Of paper.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you've got 500 pages in that paper. Ream, stack of paper, 500 pages of paper. The bottom page is the core, the center of the Earth. The top page is the crust. There is surface. One of the unique things about Yellowstone, perhaps the most unique thing, is its geologic situation, and that is that there's magma extremely close to the surface, and it's not entirely molten, this quote-unquote magma chamber. It's only about 15% liquid, and they know that because they've sent all kinds of radio waves down, and they can measure how those things bounce back. But anyway, that magma chamber, that extremely hot rock, is shockingly close to the surface of the planet in that place, and it drives all of those hot springs and geysers and other features that we see on the surface that are just otherworldly. And if you take that stack of paper and you consider how many pieces of paper you would need to go down, again, if the bottom is the center of the Earth and the top is the surface of the Earth, how many pieces of paper do you think you'd need to go down in that stack of paper to get to that magma chamber, is how I posed it.
And what do most people say?
Most people will say, I don't know, like halfway, 35 pages. The answer is one single page. That's how close we are to rocks that would turn you into jelly, or really probably turn you into steam very quickly if you were to be exposed to them. And
Jesus.
Thin
little sheet that we're all driving through, taking photos way too close to bison.
Yeah, we forget, right?
Wow.
Easy to forget. Yeah. And you can, so if you're an explorer bumping across the West way back in the 1800s, it wasn't necessarily the big scenery, the mountains, the expansive landscapes, not even the wildlife like the elk or the bison roaming around that were really the most amazing things you were coming across and the most unique things that you were coming across as you came to Yellowstone. It was the hot springs, the water that's boiling on the surface naturally, the geysers shooting steaming water hundreds of feet into the air. Those were the things that were really truly unique and spectacular as you moved across the West, and that's what caught people's imagination.
It's so wild that they all, that the geysers will also erupt so consistently, right? Everyone knows when they're going to erupt, and that just that they do so with that consistency is something that you wouldn't, to a layman, you wouldn't expect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an incredibly dynamic place. These geysers are erupting, some of them once every hour or so, in the case of Old Faithful, the most famous of the geysers. Some erupt every few decades. They can't predict all of them. And there certainly are a lot of people and a lot of smart brain power, dedicated to sorting out exactly what's happening below the surface of the earth in Yellowstone. Because we can learn a lot. You know, they give out 150 or so scientific licenses to study in Yellowstone every single year. And they like half of those licenses are just to study the life that lives in those hot springs in Yellowstone, because it's such a unique source of those kinds of microbes.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy. So you were telling me also that in 1809, when the Lewis and Clark party came through the Bozeman area,
probably closer to 1806.
That one of their party members went off solo to live in Yellowstone by themselves. Tell me a bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah. Gosh, see, things did stick. yeah. Lewis and Clark, their famous expedition to the Pacific, 1804 to 1806. On their way back through the area here, they never did find themselves up in what today is Yellowstone National Park. But on their way back through, there was a member of their party, a guy by the name of John Coulter, famous mountain man. He was the hunter of the expedition, the guy that was providing all the food for Lewis and Clark and all of their mates. And John Coulter split off from the company and went up the Yellowstone River to trap and just to explore and see what was up there. And we think today that John Coulter was probably the first person of European descent to end up in what today is Yellowstone National Park.
Whoa.
And of course, he was coming across all kinds of native groups and native people that were using the area already. But yeah, it was at that time, sometime around 1806, 1807, when this guy decided to go see what was up there, that Europeans first made their way into that territory.
You say that there are 27 tribes that lay claim to some use in Yellowstone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, claim some level of... So at the moment, yeah, 27 different tribes claim some level of heritage story originating in Yellowstone National Park, or some level of use of the natural resources and landscape of Yellowstone.
Right, but no one would, none of those tribes would live there throughout winter.
Right, pretty hostile landscape. I think the coldest ever recorded temp in Yellowstone is like negative 66 degrees. So it gets extremely hard to live in a landscape like that in the winter months. And people were nomadic. They would move out of that place and they would live there in the summer because it is a very productive landscape at times of the year. But at certain times of the year, it seems totally dormant. Which isn't to say the hot springs and geysers aren't erupting year-round, but yeah, the wildlife is not always there.
Is Yellowstone significantly higher than latitude than Bozeman?
Lower latitude.
Sorry, not latitude.
Okay, yeah. elevation.
Elevation. God damn it.
Definitely, yes, you're onto something there. So a lot of rivers begin in Yellowstone country because it is kind of like this volcanic plateau that's been pushed up by the pressure of that magma chamber I was talking about over time, something around an average of 7,000 feet. Tallest point in the park's 11,300 or something, Eagle Peak. Lowest point in the park is closer to 5,000. So there's a huge amount of topography in the park, but averaging something around 7,000 feet, and it's been pushed up to that level over time by the volcanic activity down below, and that has all kinds of implications to the life that can live there.
So you were telling me also, just for people who don't know, I didn't know it in any detail, that so the Lewis and Clark party, so they were following the Missouri River to try and find a passage across the country. And then when they arrived in Bozeman, this guy, John Coulter, he was their hunting party, and then he took off, or he was their kind of designated hunter. And why would they let him leave?
Maybe it was kind of like mission accomplished. I'm not an expert on Lewis and Clark expedition by any means. I'm sure they had other guys that were capable of performing the functions that, right, John Coulter was performing for the party. And it's my understanding that Lewis and Clark, you know, were together on their way west, but actually were splitting up a little bit more and exploring different terrain on their way back, not just retracing their steps. And so they were still out to explore new areas. And probably, actually, it was just Captain William Clark, one member of the leading party, Lewis and Clark, that split off and came through what today is the Gallatin Valley, Bozeman area. And that's when this guy, John Coulter, split off. So lots of the party kind of splitting up on the way back and amazingly finding each other on the landscape somehow. That's one thing that blows my mind about expeditions like that these guys would split up on this giant landscape and somehow find each other,
right,
you know, days, weeks, months later.
What was the book that you recommended that tracks the Lewis and Clark expedition?
It's called Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose.
Wow.
Yeah, good Lewis and Clark book.
And when John returned, he was claiming that there were these geysers that would shoot into the air and no one believed him. Is that right?
Well, you can imagine this wild-eyed mountain man coming down from the mountains after a winter spent in some of the most rugged terrain in the lower 48, telling people about rainbow-colored pools and hot springs shooting, or geysers rather, shooting water hundreds of feet in the air and 300-foot waterfalls cascading over yellow-colored canyons.
Dude. Wow.
It's fantastical stuff, and so for a very long time, nobody really believed what John Coulter had to say about what he had seen. For a long time, they referred to that place as Coulter's Hell, you know, not quite believing what he had to say, that it was some fantastical vision of this mountain man that came down. And it really wasn't until the early 1870s, maybe 65 years later, that the government finally started to put together some expeditions, organized expeditions to explore that place that more and more people were talking about, coming down the mountains with stories about what Yellowstone was all about.
Wow. You told me another fun fact, which is that Yellowstone is, you could fit 12 New York cities inside Yellowstone.
That's the quick
Yellowstone one.
Guide fact. Yeah, all of Rhode Island and Delaware combined, and it's huge. It's an absolutely massive national park. It's also the world's first national park. March 1st, 1872 is when it was created, and it really set in action a whole lot of other national parks. Today, there are thousands around the world. But Yellowstone was the first, so that is one of the facts I try to drive home for visitors there, that this was a big, audacious idea that started with Yellowstone National Park, and it really is a meaningful place for that reason. On top of that, Yellowstone has all of the big, charismatic megafauna wildlife species that you may have seen if you were John Coulter when you first went up there. Still has all of those animals today. It's the only place in North America you can say that for, that still has that full suite of wildlife that would have existed at the time.
If I'm not mistaken, the story of buffalo is that, you know, prior to hunting them to near extinction, there were somewhere between 30 and 60 million buffalo roaming North America. And at their lowest point in was it the late 1800s? There was only a remnant herd of something like 300 left on Yellowstone.
So in Yellowstone, there are only 23 individuals left. And there may have been other tiny little wild herds around. Kind of hard to say, right? So many pockets where animals could have been hiding out. But only they think only 23 bison left in that part of North America at the time, which is incredible. Yeah, all the way down from 30 to 60 million, which is a huge wide-ranging estimate. But we just didn't have biological studies and population estimates happening with the kind of rigor they are happening today. They had to sort of decide how many were in the West based on historical accounts of bison roaming around. But from a huge number, you know, a mountain man would tell you they can cross your path for 6 days at a time without pause. Just seas of bison roaming around the West, down to 23 individuals in Yellowstone National Park. There were domestic herds. They do raise bison for meat consumption. And so they were able to pen up those bison in Yellowstone after they created the national park, feed them hay, protect them from predators, bring in some domestic bison to create a little bit of genetic diversity, and then bring the numbers back. And today we have closer to 4,000 to 5,000 bison in Yellowstone National Park, depending what time of year it is.
Mm. I remember reading a short book called Rifle in Hand. Have you read that book?
Nope, but I've heard of it.
It's good. It's a short book that will, like, if you become a hunter, I think it's a good requisite read to understand the North American conservation model and how we got here. There's a line in it where Teddy Roosevelt, who was a big hunter, conservation advocate, went on a hunt on a buffalo hunt because in his presidency, apparently he could just take off for weeks at a time and go on hunts. And he said, while on the hunt, I was never out of sight of a dead buffalo and never in sight of a live one.
Wow.
So that shows, you know, just that it apparently, as contrast from the mountain men who could see buffalo for a week at a time without ever stopping, towards the late 1800s, there were just these death camps of buffalo for as far as the eye can see, which is, I think, a really great story of conservation and story of the resilience of nature and story of a lot of the work that you do and why it's important, which is that, like, if you give nature an inch, it'll take a mile. We just need to set up a system and have various practices in place that allow nature to have a chance, and we can coexist with it rather well. But it does take that kind of forethought that people like Teddy Roosevelt and many other forward-thinking folks at the time had to not just hunt creatures to extinction and turn the planet into a giant cement parking lot.
Yeah, and so there's kind of two schools of, to simplify it, two schools of conservation thought. One that is tempting, but a little idealistic in my opinion, that the best thing we can do is just hands off, you know, remove the human element, get people out of there, remove all of our impacts from the landscape and let it thrive. Just let it do its thing. And some people, when they arrive in Yellowstone, for example, think that's what's going on. But the reality is we still fight wildfires in that landscape. We actually still manage that bison population today for reasons we can get into. We still manage some of the predator populations in Yellowstone, particularly when they migrate out of the park naturally. We still have a hand, you know, for example, have a hand in controlling the human impact. I guess I'm running out of examples of how, but there's this school of thought that, you know, best thing we can do, hands off, let's just let nature do its thing. But if we would have done that with bison way back, likely that would have been the end of bison. I mean, there are ways we've damaged the ecosystem that we really need to have a careful cultivating hand, a force, a human touch to bring back. Right. You know, another way that we've impacted the landscape that I personally believe it's our duty to try to undo or at least make better. There are a lot of non-native invasive weeds that are impacting this landscape now that have been brought by humans. And without carefully controlling weeds or thinking about how we use grazing, there's a lot of innovative ways to think about how we control weeds. Using grazing, for example, to control weed populations, that problem might just run away at this point. So I do think there's a place for people to be stewards of a landscape still that really benefits the landscape more than if we were just absent entirely.
Right. Yes, I agree with you. And my the way I tried to describe that earlier maybe was not correct in that, yes, it's that we need very sober-minded ecologists and biologists and to be constantly monitoring when a species has reached its carrying capacity. And I think that makes it really interesting. I think it makes a lot of those careers really interesting because you are putting your finger on the pulse of the wild and you're having to think through really complex problems that I think people who tend to not be engaged in that work and in those worlds can really easily have a romanticized and simplistic view of what nature is and how humans should interact with it.
Right.
I just think that, I mean, our species is, yeah, it's we're animals and we're also very different from animals. And the impact that humans have had on this planet already and are continuing to have requires us to have different expectations for ourselves in how we engage with nature, because a bison population isn't going to manage an antelope population, right? Like we just need to set different expectations for ourselves simply because of our problem-solving abilities and our ability to organize in large groups that makes humans very unique.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. What do you think?
It's complex. It's easy to live in a bubble and think that, I don't think everybody would even agree on the number of bison we should have on the landscape. Mm. In fact, I know they don't. There are other values, and one of those is economic value, or let's just say food security, things that we all want. There's a lot of agriculture happening in this valley and nearby, for example. Mm. And just to hone in on one source of conflict here is that bison harbor this disease, and they carry a disease called brucellosis. Cattle can also contract brucellosis. In fact, cattle, European cattle, brought brucellosis to the area, but nowadays there's this wild reservoir for brucellosis, and it's bison. And by the way, it's also elk, but nobody really talks about that part of this story. And so there's a conflict there. We have beef producers that are concerned that if we allow bison populations to grow and expand unfettered, they'll come into contact with their beef herds, their beef cattle herds, and they'll contract this disease, brucellosis, and brucellosis will oftentimes cause cows to abort their first calves early. And obviously, if you're a rancher, that's not great. Mm. It represents a huge economic burden, really, to your bottom line if you're trying to produce food and have this agricultural operation. And so there are real reasons why, you know, from other people's points of view, we need to think about how we manage natural resources differently, and that the best thing for us as a species or even for the planet is not just to let bison return to the number they once were. Mm. 'Cause we live in a different world now.
You mentioned that there is, would you call it culling of bison population on Yellowstone? Is that the correct term that you'd use?
Cull, yeah.
Cull. So, is the reason for that so that the bison populations don't begin to impact ranch lands, or are there other reasons as well?
Yeah, that's the primary reason. It's that conflict I just described is the primary reason to manage numbers down to sort of a lower sustainable number. it's a pretty contentious thing even to say what the carrying capacity of the environment for bison is in Yellowstone. People haven't agreed on that number. I can't help but think of Doug Smith, the Yellowstone wolf biologist that just retired, and I watched his retirement speech, and he said, you know, one thing that stuck with me that he said was, it's not really about the science. It's about the social values here. It's about how we communicate and decide as a community what, in his case, wolves mean to us. And he had been producing scientific papers giving population numbers and carrying capacity estimates and the way wolves impacted cattle operations and elk populations, etc., for a long, long time. And he said none of that data really mattered in the end. It was just about how people felt about wolves. And I don't remember where I was going with this.
Well, that's really, I think it's like the people make decisions. Humans make decisions based off of emotion, not information.
Right, right. Yeah. Especially in this context, but probably all kinds of different
wolves
worlds.
Are like liberal. like you know, like whites, like the fact that a species has become such a politicized issue is a wild concept, right? That like, oh, you're into wolves, fucking Subaru driving liberal, right? Like just that we have attached our emotion to it to such a degree that animal specifically has become such a contentious topic. You know, it's like right next to like vaccines.
Yeah. I hate to draw too many conclusions or lines between different topics and attribute them to one group of folks. But yeah, it's true that if you love wolves, you might be labeled as an outsider in certain communities. And it does become a political thing around here for sure.
What, for people who know nothing about the wolf issue, how would you give them the, you know, just the quick elevator breakdown on that?
How tall of a building? How long of an elevator ride is this?
We're going to a skyscraper. Give me the long elevator pitch on the wolf issue.
Here's the broken down elevator pitch.
I'm guessing that people ask about this when you're guiding in Yellowstone.
Absolutely.
Right?
People are very taken with Yellowstone wildlife, as I am and was. So I understand when people show up and they're like, show me the bears and tell me the story of wolves. And at least the second question there is a fun one to address. We do see bears in the park, but not every day. And people don't necessarily always realize that they're not coming to a zoo. Anyway, I digress. Wolves are a fascinating story in Yellowstone because in the early 1900s, sometime around 1926 or so, it was actually a Park Service employee that shot the last wolf in Yellowstone. For a long time, predator control was the policy. You know, we saw wolves still as a detriment to the ecological system. They're killing elk and they're killing other hoofed animals, and that's a real problem because we want those animals to be around forever. There was just a real lack of understanding of how these processes play out in an ecological system, and so they wanted to rid the wolves from the landscape in order to protect those populations. So the last wolf was shot in 1926, and it wasn't until 1995 it would have been, when wolves were first brought back to the park. Another example of how humans, by way of careful stewardship, although it may have been a contentious issue, created a huge amount of change, potentially positive, potentially negative, depending who you are, by bringing wolves back to this ecosystem where they had been absent for 70 years or so. And we as humans, went up to Canada and helicopter darted and trapped and brought wolves back from British Columbia and Alberta. And I hope they make a Hollywood movie out of it someday because it's a fascinating story. There's a court case at the time to try to shut it all down. And interestingly, the most pro-wolf people and the most anti-wolf people were kind of on the same side saying, stop, don't let this reintroduction happen. And it's obvious why anti-wolf folks would not want wolves brought back to the landscape. But the most pro-wolf people also did not want wolves brought back to the landscape, or at least some of them didn't want wolves brought back, because if wolves are introduced to a landscape, they have a different protection status. They're not necessarily given full protections under the Endangered Species Act as they would otherwise if they had repopulated naturally onto the landscape. So some people would have preferred that we wait for them to repopulate on their own. But we did go up to Canada and brought back wolves.
Right. So quick question. Were wolves in the greater Montana area? And the idea is that they would have repopulated Yellowstone naturally without being reintroduced.
They were existing on the landscape in the greater area. I don't know if that necessarily includes Montana. That's a great question. But because they still existed in the Rocky Mountains of Canada, the thought was that they will eventually spread down and be reproducing, have reproductively viable packs in Yellowstone eventually. When these things happen, as is happening in Colorado right now, there's always a lot of argument about where exactly they are already and where they're reproducing already. And you can't, it's very hard to get those facts quite straight. But regardless, it would have taken some time, and maybe a long time, for wolves to naturally come back and repopulate in the park. So they brought 31 wolves at first in 1995 and 1996. In 1997, they brought 10 more wolves down from Glacier National Park that were causing some problems up in that region. And so in total, 41 wolves were brought back to the park in the mid-1990s. And then already by late 1997, 1998, if I'm remembering correctly, there was something like 86 wolves already in the park. So from 41 up to 86 or so wolves in the park, numbers just exploded, because that park population of herbivores, the elk, the deer, the prey species for wolves, was just primed and ready, and they were somewhat naive from living in a landscape without wolves for so long, such that wolves could really take advantage of returning to this landscape, and their population, their numbers just boomed in the first few years.
Whoa. And what is the wolf population in Yellowstone now?
It has hovered, it has stabilized and hovered right around 100 animals in about 10 different packs, depending on the year, about 10 animals per pack on average. And it has been, interestingly, right around 100 for quite some time now.
Mm. Have you seen many wolves in Yellowstone?
Yeah, absolutely. There are certain times a year when you can pretty reliably get out there and see a wolf.
Mm. So, correct me on any of this. How would you describe the... I won't even try and fumble my way through this. How would you describe the current anti-wolf sentiment if you were to steel man that argument?
There's a few different groups of people that are typically tagged as being anti-wolf. One, and perhaps the most powerful voice, again, are agricultural producers in the area, because, again, a real... I think coming from a pretty honest place of we're being impacted, our livelihoods are being impacted by this predator, and we wish we had more agency to control that factor affecting our livelihoods. So you can kind of understand where they're coming from there. Whether or not the data supports that is of a lot of debate in certain places like Stacy's Old Faithful Bar down the road. Another group, for example, that is sometimes tagged as being anti-wolf are hunters. Elk populations will change the way they behave, and sometimes numbers will be lower in the presence of healthy wolf populations. And if you are like us and still have a couple tags in your pocket that you'd love to fill by harvesting an animal, you can start to think that wolves are a real detriment to what you'd like to do, which is go out there and harvest food for yourself from the landscape. Of course, I think that's not a particularly nuanced thing, because I'm a hunter and I don't mind sharing the landscape with wolves, and I'm pretty happy to see a wolf while I'm hunting. But those are the few of the more traditionally anti-wolf groups. Mm.
And what is the argument to reintroduce wolves to Colorado right now? And what's the situation there? And what's the pro sentiment? What's the argument that we should be What does I mean, just describe what's happening.
Yeah, I'm less educated on the situation in Colorado, but the general gist would be, just to rewind the clock a little, in 1963, a gentleman by the name of Aldo Leopold, a famous ecologist, really the one of the founders of the idea of ecology and landscape ecology, came out with this report, an ecological report. The Leopold Report, it's sometimes called. And again, that was in 1963. And ever since then, ecologists have been arguing for a fully intact ecosystem that includes the full suite of predators, as well as prey, as well as every other critter that should be involved in that food web, in order to sustain a much more healthy, enriched system, right, that is indeed more sustainable and will be more resilient as well to things like climate change.
We're looking at Aldo Leopold's book, The Sand County Almanac, which is maybe the most famous book in kind of hunting, would you say? I mean, I remember hearing about that book very early on, and it's become kind of like a Bible of sorts.
I would say the Bible is the most famous book in hunting.
No, yeah, that's funny.
Any proud Wisconsinite such as myself, has Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac on their bookshelf somewhere. The guy famously is from Wisconsin and formed a lot of these ideas while spending time observing his property in Wisconsin and the ecological processes happening on his property. A lot to be said about that book, but absolutely, it is a pillar of this philosophy and idea of landscape ecology and intact systems being the healthiest type of nature.
And so right now, what is happening in Colorado?
So, gosh, having not lived in Colorado for a couple of years, I don't know if I'm totally hip to the current status, but last I heard, the population had voted to mandate the state to create a reintroduction plan. That was kind of the first step in possibly reintroducing wolves. So moving in the direction of doing this again, what they had done in Yellowstone, but this time in Colorado, bringing wolves back to a landscape from which they've been absent for a long time, by transplanting animals down. And, you know, Colorado is interesting. There's something like 80% of the population lives on the Front Range. That is kind of the Denver, Fort Collins, Longmont, Colorado Springs corridor, the I-25 corridor. And so, but very likely they will introduce wolves to the western side of the state. That's the opposite side of the state where there are many fewer people living. And so you have this situation where the majority of the voting population is not living on the side of the state where wolves are likely to be introduced. And so likely the people who would be most impacted by the presence of wolves were not really the majority voters in the situation. And that's why I feel some complex emotions about this whole thing. Certainly, again, love to see wolves on the landscape, but I understand that I want to be sensitive to the fact that different people are going to be impacted differently by the presence of wolves on the landscape. So in some people's minds, it's a complex situation, and they might be moving towards reintroduction, but it will certainly impact the ecosystem and the population in different ways.
So working in Yellowstone, what do you feel like you got out of that job experience?
Truthfully, I think I learned more about people than I did about wildlife by hanging out in Yellowstone. I think any ranger up there would tell you that the job is more about human crowd control than it is about animal control and saving people from themselves. Honestly, I've gotten like to sit in a vehicle and drive and talk about nature with basically what I would consider to be a cross-section of America. Like I'm sitting in the vehicle with on the Griswold family vacation for like hundreds of different families for a day and just getting like a slice of life from these people from all over the place. And they all share this reverence for the natural world and getting outdoors and experiencing cool places like Yellowstone. And it's really wonderful position to be in, to be able to help them learn more about that and have a really great experience. And at the same time, I am certainly feeling like I'm learning lots about them and truthfully about subcultures of America for which that I just would not identify with personally.
So your job was doing private tours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And these were like, so they're typically more like people who want to come into Yellowstone, pay the big bucks and see the best of it and probably don't have much time.
Right. And I don't want to paint my clients and the people that I'm going on tour with in Yellowstone as the other, because I do have a really great time as I learn a lot about these other people that I'm spending time with in Yellowstone. But there's really no better time than to just cruise around Yellowstone with some people and chew the fat and learn about them as they learn about this natural, wonderful place. And yes, that is what we do. So I take people on often single-day private tours of Yellowstone in a single vehicle and show them the highlights, typically show off some of our wildlife resources, and take them to see geysers, hot springs, just kind of like a best of Yellowstone. And for some people, if they're limited on time, that's the best way to see the highlights of Yellowstone. The mm-hmm. best of Yellowstone is to hire a guide and do it rather efficiently. Yellowstone, again, is so huge. 2.2 million acres.
Yeah, you're
inside.
Not going to see all of it.
You're not going to see all of it. There's something like over 400 miles of road in Yellowstone. So to have somebody that's a local that knows all the places to stop and where not to stop and the order and time of day to do it, so you avoid the big crowds and see the wildlife where it's active in this place and then go over here, I think it is of value.
Mm.
And people are generally pretty happy with the tour. And it's, I would consider this is one of the easiest jobs I've ever had because Yellowstone speaks for itself. I mean, you take people for a tour in Yellowstone and they can enjoy the majesty and splendor without you giving them facts
totally.
All day.
Yeah. That's all just gravy on top.
Yeah.
That's super cool. And now working, so you moved to Bozeman a couple years ago, and now you're working at the Gallatin Valley Land Trust. Tell me a little bit about that and what that kind of work is, how it relates back to this wide-ranging conversation we've had.
Yeah, I have moved away from the full-time Yellowstone guiding in order to pursue a career in conservation again. Which isn't to say that educators like guides don't have a place in the world of conservation, but this job with the Gallatin Valley Land Trust I see as kind of an extension of my work in Colorado. So the Nature Conservancy I was working for in Colorado is a land trust organization. Now I'm working for a smaller regional land trust that works specifically in just a few counties here in this part of Montana. And it's an extension particularly of the land protection work that I was doing in the land stewardship work I was doing in Colorado, and that is primarily through the tool of conservation easements that I think we've talked a little bit about before.
Right. The sticks. Remember the sticks.
Stick metaphor.
You love the sticks.
Classic real estate.
Classic real estate. So are you you're continuing to work with a lot of these ranchers out here?
Yeah. It's interesting to have a new appreciation and perspective for the people working in these landscapes. So what we're trying to do essentially is to protect the conservation value of private lands by working with private landowners to secure their land through what are called conservation easements. And it is my job to basically, one of probably the primary function of my job is to visit or maintain some kind of relationship with these properties and these landowners in order to ensure that the terms of the conservation easement agreement are upheld, to make sure that the conservation values are intact on their landscape as agreed in the original legally binding agreement.
Right.
And a big part of that is indeed maintaining relationships with these people to make sure that they disclose whatever level of allowable development is happening on their property so that we can make sure that it doesn't impact some of the natural values that we decided on when we first made that agreement. And importantly, I'm not always working with the original grantor of that agreement. So the guy that originally signed that document to say, yes, I am willing to say that we will never build a giant mansion or a subdevelopment on this property, that original grantor may have sold the property to somebody else. But the important thing about these conservation easement agreements is that they are in perpetuity, which means forever.
Right.
That document will forever protect that landscape from a certain level of development.
Mm. And yeah, despite whether or not the person has sold the ranch to someone else.
Right.
And what does an easement give a rancher typically?
It's a little complicated depending on the situation of the producer. And by the way, these aren't always producers. Sometimes it's people who just have a large chunk of land. Maybe they only use it for recreation and they want to make sure that it never is developed in the future.
Right.
But oftentimes these landowners are benefiting in the form of tax breaks. Or in some cases they are essentially paid, to put this agreement in place up front. That's like Colorado, for example, has a tax credit that you can sell, that is transferable tax credit that you get when you create a conservation easement. So they can actually benefit monetarily immediately for the creation of a conservation easement on their property. In some cases, it has to be more metered out, like in the case of tax deductions that you might benefit from. So typically, it's a monetary agreement.
Right. And the population's benefiting from this as well, both scenic benefit of not having a bunch of McMansions and developments across Montana.
Right.
I'd also imagine that just property value is increased across the board because of that scenic value. So if you own a house with a great view and you can ensure that it's going to look like this forever, that would increase value and interest in the area.
Yeah. And just rewind just a moment to say that sometimes people will donate conservation easements on their property.
Hmm.
And those donations may be tax deductible, but sometimes folks are just willing to donate that value of their property, that it will never be developed, which does significantly diminish the value of their property, economically speaking. And anyway, yeah, absolutely. The public there's a huge benefit to these conservation easements, at least in my eyes, and truly to the eyes of the populace here, who has regularly, very strongly supported these open space bonds that support conservation easements actively going into place. And these, our portfolio is always expanding. There are lots of people that are continuing to put their land in a conservation easement. And yeah, the public benefits in terms of scenic views, the public benefits in terms of habitat for wildlife. And remember, those are some of the reasons people are moving to Montana, right? Those
You're moving to Montana for the view.
The open natural spaces. Like
you're not moving here for the tech jobs.
Right. So it benefits you.
This is why literally everyone has come here.
So the benefits are obvious, that if that ridge can remain beautiful green pasture, maybe with some cows grazing, maybe not, maybe with deer and elk grazing and moving through, maybe just beautiful open space, there's a value to that looking and remaining that way to the public, just in terms of scenic value, rather than being 10-acre plots for homes or one single McMansion on the hill.
Right.
And so there's that value, but of course there's also, from an ecologist's point of view, leaving lands in a natural state and ecologically intact and non-developed is a heck of a lot better for carbon sequestration and buffering of flooding and other natural disaster impacts, and supports again that whole treasure trove of wildlife that needs that space to thrive. And that intact ecosystem is going to benefit us in so many ways, that private land protection is incredibly important, even to the public person that doesn't spend any time on foot on that property.
Right. It also benefits hunters, because if there's unmolested natural landscapes that are improving elk populations, even if it's on private land that most public land hunters cannot hunt, there's a good chance that those elk will wander onto public increasing the general hunting opportunity for public land hunters.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad to hear you draw that connection, because the one frequent argument against conservation easements is that there's some level of public funding, tax breaks, for example, that are going toward protecting this private landscape that I can't go hunt as Joe Hunter. And so what's the point here? But you're exactly right. The point is that landscape is going to continue to be a breeding ground and a productive landscape to produce and help the wildlife populations that you like to hunt thrive in this greater landscape. Mm. So even though you can't hunt there, it still really is beneficial for your recreational hunting that you like to pursue.
Mm. Yeah, it's we were talking earlier about how, like, just what an outdoorsy culture Bozeman is. Like, it's very unique. I think it becomes normalized when you live here for a little while, but the fact is that people move here because they love the wilderness so much. They're willing to be cold as fuck for a few months out of the year.
Yeah, I think plenty of people move here and don't realize that will be the case.
Yeah,
we
this
did
is
get
beautiful.
Down to negative 40 last year.
We came in our Winnebago in September, and it was so nice. Let's move there.
Yeah, well, it's one reason there are plenty of folks here that this is their second home here, or this is their ski chalet that they come to just for a few weeks at a time in the winter. And I don't want to generalize and make it sound like that's most of the populace here, but certainly that exists. And there are snowbirds who, move south for the winter. So it is a little bit less permanent populace, it feels, this far north. And I would also say that, you're absolutely right. A lot of people recreate here. Colorado is full of outdoor recreation too, but, it's funny. I would not say Montana is crowded, but you run into a lot of people when you're out there recreating, because it seems like just about everybody that lives here is out in it.
Right. Exactly. It's so fun. I mean, I say this often about LA. Like, LA has a lot of trails. You go into the Santa Monica Mountain Range or into Topanga or into, people don't think about Malibu as a wild place, but you can hike for 100 miles in Malibu.
Yeah.
And you're not seeing that many people. It's not a big deal. I did an 18-mile run through the Malibu Mountains. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. I wasn't tired at the end. But I saw, like, two people, through that whole area, and it was beautiful. But the fact is that people are not in L.A. to recreate. So such a small amount of that population is actually going to the outdoors, versus you come to a place like here where everyone has that value, so they're going to take advantage of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's horrible. It's really ugly here.
It sucks.
It's really cold. Please don't come.
Yeah.
You know, actually come, visit, but then go home.
That's the move.
Yeah. I see myself as part of the problem, in quotes, because I moved here recently. But I'm trying to work so that the place benefits from my presence here a little bit. And I don't want to point fingers and say that a growing population is a bad thing. I would rather live in a growing population than a shrinking population, yeah. A growing town than a shrinking town, and have growing town problems rather than shrinking town problems, I tend to think. But yeah, we moved up from Colorado, and there are a lot less people here, and there is a lot more recreational access. So it is just interesting and remarkable how many people you see out there. And yeah, I've had a lot of good conversations with strangers in the middle of nowhere, because you can be off on a backcountry hunt, and you're in some rugged little hellhole, and there are some boot tracks, and you run into this dude, and he's out there doing the exact same thing you are. And there's a lot of cool people out here. And there's a lot of smart, intellectual, awesome people doing cool work. There are so many nonprofits in town that are just pushing cool work forward that it's an awesome place to live. It really is. So I guess now I'm going back on my ugly, horrible, cold town.
Yeah. Didn't you say there's more nonprofits in Bozeman than any other? Am I making this up?
I think I'd quickly be disproved by any fact checker there, but suffice to say, there are many, many nonprofits for a relatively small town here in Bozeman, which creates kind of a cool atmosphere.
Mm, nice. So you're happy you made the move. You're happy with now with the jobby job. You feel like you're happy with making the jump.
Well, it's all just for now, right?
That's what they say.
It's good for right now. Absolutely. It's serving the lifestyle that I want to be living right now. So yeah, it's been good for me.
Mm, that's good. Do you have any sense of what kind of work you would like to get into next or where you kind of want to push your thinking about? It doesn't even necessarily need to be the next job, but just like I think that you're very aware of how you're directing the spotlight of your attention. And much of that is a spotlight on nature, which you can explore for many lifetimes. There's so much to it. There's just an endless amount to learn. Has there been any aspect of it that you've kind of been really excited to sink your brain into next?
Big wave surfing. I've been thinking.
You want to get into that?
No.
Let's do it.
Well,
I'll tow you in, man.
Sure. Great. That'll be a very short career for me. I don't have a clear picture. Mm. I definitely think I will continue to work in the spaces where humans, I'll just continue to work in the thought spaces where we're considering how humans interact and connect with the natural world and our impact on it. That's a pretty big general statement, but those are the issues and the communities that intrigue me the most, and I'll just continue to chase that curiosity. What capacity professionally I'll do that in, it's a little bit of a question mark, but yeah, man, I don't know, just chasing my curiosity and whatever allows me to spend some time in fall hunting with buddies and spend evenings fly fishing and bird hunting with my dog and out in the woods, I'll continue to do that.
Yeah. Well, I'll be back here year after year. Kyle, part of the problem. That's me. You've heard it here first, folks.
Oh, I was so disappointed that you caught a little behind your back comment at the grocery store the other day.
I know, motherfucker. Yeah. Well, do you know what it was? We had just come back from a hunt, and this was like something that has been told to me, like, don't wear camo around town. Mm. Like, people are just like, don't do it. Like, it's like it's like some surfer just wearing board shorts to the job or something. You know, you're like just people trying to overdo it, right? Like, and there's actually this concept that I've learned called Batesian mimicry, where species, like the example is there's this poisonous sea snake that has these rings around it. And there's another sea snake that is not poisonous, but has adapted to develop rings around it to ward off predators. And the idea goes for humans as well, that like people who are new to something overdo it in the way they dress and talk. And like, we all know those people, right? I always say, like, surfers don't dress like surfers. Like, if you want to see the best surfer in the parking lot, he's probably dressed like a fucking construction worker, right? And I think the same goes in hunting. Like, if you're wearing camo around town, people are going to think you're a fucking kook. And we had just come back from a fucking hunt. Oh, yeah. And I was like, fucking guy, it was like, you're fucking transplant, aren't you?
Well, you were wearing the Patagonia
God
vest and everything and a rose orange hat.
It was
He did whisper transplant behind
you
your back.
Motherfucker.
That's, yeah, yeah.
It happens.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of signaling that goes on, and the people that are signaling are typically not what they're signaling. And, man, growing up in the Midwest, or maybe it was just my personal family culture, any level of signaling or lack of humility that my family members sniffed out, or friends or brothers or whatever.
The worst crime.
You'd be called out, yeah.
The worst crime of all.
So I'm pretty hyper aware of that. There's a certain amount of practicality to you just came out of the woods where you were wearing camo and you're stopping at the grocery store, so you're still wearing camo. But there's some, I think it's a Dimitri Martin comedian, some bit from him about how, yeah, camo is like an easy way to spot an asshole in the city.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the quiet competence of Kevin Grunewald is something we can all aspire to. The man,
including me,
the man who dresses in grays and natural greens exclusively,
speaks softly and carries a big stick because there's just not a lot going on in his head.
Yeah. Well, man, this was such a blast. You delivered a massive amount of ecological information that I will have to listen back to retain it all. But I'm glad you think so.
You're much
more impressive than you think you are.
The imposter syndrome is real. I have a lot of respect and appreciation for a lot of the people you interview and the content you put out. So to have the opportunity to speak to you and host you for a big hunt here in Montana has really been pleasure's all mine.
Appreciate it, man. And where can people reach out to you to tell you that you're awesome?
Well, still not on Instagram, so email remains the best way to reach out if you want to. That is kjgrunewald@gmail.com. And I'll respond to whatever kind of stuff you send my way.
We'll put it in the description below, and then some spammer will grab it and you'll get thousands of emails about some Nigerian prince.
Right, all you Nigerian princes out there, don't bother. I'm sorry if you're actually a Nigerian prince and you want to be a buddy. It's a hard life for you.
It's a hard life. No, that would be a funny bit that you're actually a Nigerian prince that just wants friends. Oh, God. Buddy, this was such a blast. So happy to have you on the podcast, and let's keep doing it forever.
Absolutely.
That's our show. Before you head off into your day, you can go to tierman.substack.com to get my newsletter, my articles, thoughts, ramblings. If you want to hear more from me, tierman.substack.com is the place to be. That's it for now. Thank you so much for tuning in. Get out in the water, whatever body of water is closest to you, lake, river, bathtub, or ocean. I promise it will make your day better. See you soon.